Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. On today's program, another installment of Road Trip, a new series on WISO that takes you to some familiar and not so familiar places around Ohio. More poetry and politics. Also, we'll talk with Lynn Erickson with the Air Force Museum Foundation about their new campaign. Up first, David Isay is the founder of StoryCorps, familiar to all WISO listeners. Dave is also an author, and last year he released Mom, a celebration of mothers from StoryCorps. The New York Times bestseller has just been released in paperback. I spoke to Dave by phone this week. First, we talked StoryCorps.
You know, StoryCorps has been around for about 8.5 years now, and we've recorded about 40,000 interviews across the country with about 80,000 people, because most people come in pairs. And, you know, basically what happens in a StoryCorps interview is that two people come to this booth and with a trained facilitator have this 40-minute experience with a loved one. And in some ways, StoryCorps is really kind of the collecting the wisdom of humanity. Many people think of it as, if I had 40 minutes left to live, what would I say to this person who's so important to me? What would I ask of them? So, you know, moms have come up probably in every single one of the 40,000 interviews that we've recorded. So when we were thinking about doing our first book, having it be about moms was a no-brainer. And we collected several dozen of the most powerful, poetic stories of the 40,000 we've recorded. And I have to say that we look at every single interview as a sacred moment in people's lives, and none is more valuable than any other ones. But some have this kind of universal quality that make it so that they demand to be heard or demand to be read.
And so that begs the question, are there any plans to compile stories of other groups, say veterans or stories on adoption, stories of love and sacrifice? I mean, the possibilities seem endless.
Yeah, you know, and what we're trying to do with StoryCorps is to, you know, we can't nearly meet the demand of people who want to participate. And we're working hard to turn this into a sustaining, you know, national institution and someday make it possible for everyone who wants to participate to participate. We have three books out, and our latest one, Mom, just came out in paperback. We do have a book that just came out a couple months ago called All There Is, which are love stories that were recorded through StoryCorps. And there'll be more books to come. And you know, we've launched a bunch of special initiatives through StoryCorps over the years. And these are initiatives to collect stories. So we have an initiative with 9/11 families who come in. Everyone who lost a loved one on September 11th leaves a record of them through StoryCorps. We have an African-American initiative, an initiative for Latino families. Many of those stories from those initiatives go into a collection like Mom, and I actually haven't talked about it before, but we're going to announce a pretty major veterans initiative this coming fall, and many more to come. And part of the beauty of StoryCorps is that there is no group that participating in a project like this doesn't work for. So there are many, many ways to cut it, and we are determined to keep going and honoring, you know, the stories of everyday people through this project.
Great. We'll look forward to speaking with you about those future projects. And I have maybe what is a two-part question with the release of the book in paperback now. What impact has it had on your life since the release of this book? And what response have you received from readers?
I think it's, you know, this book, we've been lucky that all of the StoryCorps books have been, you know, bestsellers, and we're thrilled for any number of reasons. One is that more people get to know about StoryCorps, that people get to read these stories that I think are the important stories. It's the wisdom and poetry and grace in the words of the people all around us. Personally, I'm a dad of two young kids. And, you know, what the nature of StoryCorps is that this book, Mom, is basically the collected wisdom of being a great parent contained within two covers. So for me, it's a lesson on parenting. And in many ways, what we're doing every week with StoryCorps on the radio is presenting stories of just regular people living life to its fullest and life at its best. And you're hearing authenticity, which is so rare outside of public radio. You know, we're surrounded and bombarded with so much nonsense, and nobody comes to StoryCorps to get rich. Nobody comes to get famous. It's just about being generous with another human being and telling them how much they matter to you by listening to them. So for me, the profound influence of StoryCorps is, and of this book, and the way that I use it every day is in lessons on how to be a great and present parent.
And what about response from readers?
Well, people, you know, we get lots and lots of response. you know, people love this book. And I love to hear not only from people who've read the book, but also StoryCorps is based in New York, and I spend a lot of time, you know, fundraising for the project. And when I go on a book tour, I get to meet the people in the book. And that's probably one of the great pleasures of my job. You know, what we try to do with this book is take a 40-minute interview, and with all of our stories, and distill it into a kind of, you know, poem based on the words. It's much shorter than the original interview. And meeting folks and seeing that they are exactly as they have been portrayed in this book, and sometimes even better people, which is hard to imagine. And the most frequent response that I get from people is that they come up to me and say, you know, I wish I had interviewed my mom, but I waited too long. And, you know, that's one of the lessons I hope from StoryCorps is that people take the time to, even if you can't record it through StoryCorps on our website, storycorps.org, our instructions about how to record interviews, take the time to have this kind of conversation with a mother, with someone who matters to you, because it's something you'll never regret.
StoryCorps founder and author Dave Isay. Dave, before we go, you said StoryCorps is based out of New York, but mobile units have been canvassing the country for,
for
a number of years now, and we were lucky enough to experience that, and so it's enriched our experience and that of our listeners. And I just want to know what your thoughts are about the legacy that's being created through StoryCorps.
You know, I think one of the powerful pieces of StoryCorps is that when you record this interview, your great-great-great-grandkids are going to get to hear the story of your mom or your grandfather, or this friend who matters to you, and that, you know the power of the human voice. I mean, it's inherent to what radio is about, public radio is about, Why So is about, that the soul is kind of contained in the voice, and it's just a very powerful kind of message in the bottle for future generations. And you know, in totality, again, it basically distills the wisdom of humanity. But I also think that, you know, from Studs Terkel, the great oral historian who would have turned 100 next week, talked so eloquently about bottom-up history. You know, we often hear about history through the voices of, you know, statesmen and politicians. And I think StoryCorps and people like Studs have proved that the history through the voices and stories of everyday people, bottom-up history, as Studs talked about, is a very important, as well as the top-down sort of history. So I think people are going to get a very rich sense in the future of what life was like for people in this country at this time. And hopefully, we hope that StoryCorps will continue on forever and will continue to create this, I think, much more real sense of who we are and what we believe in and what we care about and what we've been through in this country.
Dave Isay, author of several books, including the New York Times bestseller, Mom, A Celebration of Mothers, from StoryCorps. Dave, thanks so much for your time with us.
Thanks, Jerry. Keep up the great work, and I love WYSO.
And a happy Mother's Day to all our mothers in the listening audience. Road Trip is a new series on WYSO where radio producers from around the state take us on 11 different audio tours as part of the new Ohio Guide. This week, producer Greg Tye takes us to Ohio's north coast for a little bird watching.
Along the Lake Erie shoreline, about halfway between Toledo and Sandusky, is Ohio's marsh region, which includes the Ottawa National Wildlife Refuge and McGee Marsh Wildlife Refuge. It is one of the most popular birdwatching sites in North America. Kim Kaufman is director of the Black Swamp Bird Observatory.
Each year, between mid-April and throughout much of the month of May, millions upon millions of songbirds will stop by during their migration north. The stars of the show are tiny birds called warblers, and they're here just for a brief time in the spring. And believe it or not, birders from all over the world will gather here just to see these birds.
Her husband, Ken Kaufman, is a naturalist and author of The Field Guide to Birds of North America.
Those are the birds that separate the bird watchers from everybody else, because the average person has never heard of warblers and probably hasn't seen one. And the serious birders put a lot of their attention into finding warblers. They're tiny birds. They're very colorful. They eat insects, so they can't survive here in winter, so they go to the tropics in winter. They come flooding back north in spring, and there are more than 36 kinds that come through northern Ohio. Like black pole warblers, for example, may be coming from Brazil and going to Alaska, and they're stopping off here in Ohio for a few days on the way.
These little songbirds are migrating at night, believe it or not. They navigate by the stars, and as they come up, they see this massive body of water.
And here's this beautiful little patch of woodland with marsh on one side and the lake on the other side. So they really concentrate in here on the south shore of Lake Erie.
McGee Marsh encompasses over 2,200 acres of wetland habitat and features a raised boardwalk near the lakeshore.
The boardwalk is in a small wooded area. It's about 7 acres of woods, and the boardwalk is about 3/4 of a mile long. There are perhaps nowhere else in North America that you can see these spring migrants as close as you can from that boardwalk.
Warblers in other places will be up in the tops of tall trees. There's an ailment called warbler neck that birders get from looking up at the treetops. But here the trees are relatively short. Now, the birds are very concentrated. They're feeding on small insects that tend to be down low. Here, you can stand and look at warblers at eye level.
Joe and Marianne Deshane from upstate New York are headed west to visit their grandchildren, but scheduled their trip to coincide with the spring migration at McGee Marsh.
We were here 2 years ago, I think, and it was we saw a lot of birds, and it was just a good experience. Wow, I saw a Cape May warbler that was just really right up in the tree, really, really close. I had a very good view of it. That was a highlight for me.
McGee Marsh itself is just so great because it's compact. It's not a huge area. When I hear that this thing is 7 acres, I think, well, what can you see in 7 acres? But you can walk this boardwalk and you want to come back and do it again and again, again, again. You see so much and they're all right close in.
I know some people who have come back in May every year for the last 20 years. And there are tour groups that come here based not only in the U.S. but in Canada and in England that'll bring an entire group here from other countries to witness the spring migration.
The warblers are here through May, but other birds, including bald eagles, are visible in the Ohio Marsh region year-round. From McGee Marsh, near the lakeshore, I'm Greg Tye.
You can download a free audio tour of Natural Ohio from the lake to the woods at coohiofirst.org. The new Ohio Guide is produced by the Ohio Humanities Council, a state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. This is WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. I'm Jerry Kenney. Thanks for joining us. The Air Force Museum Foundation was formed in 1960 as a philanthropic nonprofit organization to assist in the development and expansion of the National Museum of the United States Air Force. Lynn Erickson is Chief Development Officer, and I spoke to her by phone about the foundation's new fundraising campaign revealed at Dayton's 5th Third Field last week.
We announced the public phase, which we're calling the final approach, and really we're asking folks in the region to step forward and help us achieve the full goal, help us land the project on schedule with this, you know, image of final approach in terms of the last phase. It is a $48 million project. We have raised $38 million thus far from the business operations and also from philanthropic gifts. We have announced prior to this time two very large philanthropic gifts, $10 million from Lockheed Martin and $5 million from Boeing. And then we have several other smaller gifts and several gifts pending. But we're really looking at the last $10 million to get us there and, you know, land this project on schedule, because we would like to go to construction in 2013 and then open the building at the end of 2014. This is a project for a fourth major building on the main museum campus, similar in size to the last one that was that opened in 2003 was the Kettering Cold War Gallery. So this would be adjacent to that. And there we have three galleries planned for inside that building that will really expand the story of the Air Force's contribution to the nation's development and achievements. And I think that that's a really interesting aspect. This building is going to look at the broader role that the Air Force plays and include a space gallery with an incredible space shuttle exhibit, not the, you know, artifact. We didn't get the space shuttle, but we are getting a crew compartment trainer, which has two decks, which is where all the Air Force astronauts were trained. And we're going to build out our own shuttle and add on the cargo bay, the wings, and you'll be able to go inside. There'll be interactive exhibits. So kind of the feature aspect of the space gallery will be this space shuttle exhibit. Then we will have the presidential aircraft gallery. And right now the presidential aircraft are on display, but they're on display on the base behind the fence. And to go there, you have to go online or come here and sign up. And there's a, you know, one bus almost every hour. And if, you know, if space is available, you can get over there. But only about 10% of the visitors get over onto the base to see the presidential aircraft. And the third gallery will tell the story of global reach and really the story of airlift and air refueling and the notion that the Air Force can protect us and be anywhere around the world, you know, within 24 hours because of this incredible airlift capability.
It seems like you've got the purposes for this new facility pretty well defined, and I'm sure you're going to have no problem packing in visitors. You're still, the museum is still serving, I believe, over 1 million visitors each year?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, and I think that this will, you know, there's no real way to predict, but I would expect this to bump that number up, and that's a big impact for this region.
You mentioned that with the new campaign, you're asking for help from the public. In what ways are you doing that?
A variety of ways. There's a number of options. One is we'd love to have you become a member of the Friends program. It's called the Friends of the Museum. And as a member, you're entitled to various benefits. Among those are discounts at the IMAX Theater, discounts in the store, and you know special opportunities for participation in some of the programs and activities here. Another option is to make a donation, and you can make a donation online. You know, our website is www.airforcemuseum.com, and it's very obvious. You get online, and it says donate and click here. You can text. We just kicked off on, it was supposed to be Monday night, but the game got rained out, but Tuesday night, this mobile giving campaign. So you can text 50555. And then the message is expand. Our campaign is called Expanding the Legacy, and it's about expanding, you know, the museum. So if you type expand and you send that to 50555, then, you know, there'll be some little messages on the screen and allows you to confirm that you'd like to make a $10 donation. And the way that works then, that $10 donation ends up on your phone bill, you know. And this is so important for Dayton. I think it's really a privilege for us to have a national museum in Dayton, Ohio, that we can go back to and our families can go many, many times and take advantage of all the events and programs, and there's no cost. But we can also attract, you know, lots of other folks to this region.
Lynn Erickson, Air Force Museum Foundation Chief Development Officer. Good luck with everything.
Well, thank you very much.
This is WISO Weekend on WYSO. Thanks for making us a part of your Sunday morning. Doug McGregor and Margaret Maddox are a brother-sister team and natives of Springfield. As soon as Doug graduated from culinary school in Colorado, his sister called him and convinced him to come back home and open a restaurant with her nearly 5 years ago. WYSO's Wayne Baker reports that the duo's restaurant, Seasons Bistro and Grill, is now a big part of Springfield's downtown renaissance and a continuing effort in the family's long line of successful business ownership. Wayne sat down with Doug, Margaret, and Krista McGaw of the Tecumseh Land Trust to talk to them about a project they're working on.
Margaret Maddox felt like Springfield needed a few more dining options, and opening Seasons would be a fun family project. Her brother Doug had spent several years cooking in Colorado restaurants, and Margaret herself had spent time in Nashville learning about the food industry. They developed a unique idea for their eatery. Seasons offers a menu that changes each season, highlighting the freshest foods that winter, spring, summer, and fall have to offer. To do that, they made a connection with local farms to stock their restaurant.
We definitely try to support the local farms, try to buy as much of the ingredients locally as possible. Go to the farmer's market in Yellow Springs. Springfield has a nice farmer's market. It's the best product we can get our hands on.
But it's more a matter of you know, fresh foods and, you know, trying to keep things interesting and, you know, fun different ways of preparing foods and just with an emphasis on things being fresh and prepared right there, you know, and in the moment as opposed to frying everything or, you know, purchasing things pre-made. You know, we're making pretty much everything from scratch in our own kitchen.
Seasons' efforts to be a positive part of downtown Springfield's rebirth is not lost on Krista McGall of the Tecumseh Land Trust. Her organization has made the restaurant a destination for its big yearly fundraiser on Tuesday. And a large part of the site selection is due to what the eatery stands for.
We're really enthusiastic about every restaurant that features local fresh food and also just orients people to seasonal eating. It's one of those things that people have gotten out of touch with. You can get the same old all year round, and it comes from Lord knows where to maybe another country. But these guys just have got such a refreshing idea to really have that seasonal menu. They get creative. I like it that they change the season when they decide it's time to change the seasonal menu. They're tired. They're ready to move on, ready for spring or ready for summer. So it's just such a natural fit. And, of course, we preserve a lot of farms in Clark County.
Well, our family has a pretty long history in Springfield. Our great-great-grandfather and his brother actually had a greenhouse company, and they sold roses, and they were very successful. And so that's kind of, you know, set that standard for us and given us that inspiration, I guess, a little bit. Our dad was in business with his brother and his father, and so we have roots in the community, and we think it's a great place. And
it is home. It's where the family is. And, yeah, I do have, you know, fairly vague memories of downtown Springfield back in the day, going down to the Wrens and all the neat architecture that used to be down there and still is down there.
And you were talking about in the family a greenhouse. Is that right?
That's correct. It was catalog driven, I think, and they mailed catalogs all over the world and sold their roses all over the world. They specialized in roses.
And we still have several of those catalogs.
Yeah.
Who founded the greenhouse?
Was it Frank and David?
Frank and David
McGregor.
Yep, just following the Civil War.
And I guess the family has always had that entrepreneurial spirit.
5 years ago, you might have had to leave Springfield to find a place that offers fine dining with a connection to local farms. Now, that type of eating experience awaits in downtown Springfield. For WYSO, I'm Wayne Baker reporting.
Thanks for joining us on WYSO Weekend. We continue our series of poetry readings from the Dayton Metro Library with David Garrison, a recently retired professor from Wright State University.
I've got three short poems. They all have something to do with poetry, I guess. The first one is sort of about art itself. It's called Apples and Oranges. Sometimes we wonder where poems came from, and this came from that phrase, like, this is comparing apples to oranges. Apples and Oranges. God practiced on the kiwi and the pineapple before perfecting the orange and the apple that lounge against each other in a bowl, giving all things a right to be different. The apple puffs its chest. The orange, round like the world, invites you to explore it. Crunch an apple and suck the juice between your teeth. Lick the rose of the skin, eat the flesh. Bite open an orange, then peel it with your fingers, slide a section into your mouth, and make it explode. This one's called Playing Bach in the D.C. Metro, and this goes back to an actual event. The Washington Post asked the famous concert violinist Joshua Bell to play his Stradivarius in a D.C. Metro station to see what would happen. And this is about what happened. Playing Bach in the D.C. Metro. For a story, the Washington Post had a concert violinist wearing jeans, tennis shoes, and a baseball cap stand near a trash can at rush hour in the D.C. Metro and play Bach on a Stradivarius. Partita number 2 in D minor sang to commuters in the station, Why We Must Live. 1,000 people streamed by. 7 of them paused, and $32 floated into the open violin case. A cafe hostess who drifted to the door whenever she was free said Bach gave her peace. And children waded into the music as if it was water, listening until rescued by parents who had somewhere to go. And finally, this is a new poem. It's called Sonia. And where did this come from? I bought a used book and there was an inscription from the poet to Sonia. And so I started wondering who Sonia was and thinking about her. Bought a used book of poems and found below the title the poet's handwritten inscription to Sonia at Drake University, 2005. Sonia's fingers warm each tattered page. I imagine her telling her father how much she loves the poetry of W.D. Snodgrass. He is afraid she'll major in English and marry some sad young man who wears a beret and live with him in a low-rise brick apartment complex where they'll cut coupons to survive. She reads her favorite lines to him, and pride grips his chest so tightly that for a moment he too loves poetry. And he remembers the time his mother read him that poem about the highwayman who came riding, riding on a ribbon of moonlight over the purple moor. I slide the book between two others on the shelf and hear the scrape of Sonia's backpack across her shoulder as she hurries off to class. Thank you.
Welcome to Politics Ohio. I'm Ellen Belcher, filling in for Emily McCord. I'm talking with State Senator Peggy Lehner, a Republican from Kettering and the chair of the Senate committee that hears all the proposals related to education in Ohio. Thanks for chatting, Senator Lehner.
Thanks for having me.
Ohio is one of 45 states that has adopted something called the Common Core, which are new achievement standards for elementary, middle, and high schools. Everyone agrees that these new expectations, which districts in Ohio are phasing in, are decidedly more difficult than what most schools are teaching kids today. Proponents of the Common Core say teachers will have to focus more on teaching critical thinking skills and writing. They say that Ohio's current proficiency tests force teachers to cover too much ground and to do so in a shallow way. And they complain that students don't really have to master complex topics to pass the multiple choice proficiency exams. Do you agree?
Well, I think the proof is in the pudding, frankly. We have become increasingly aware that American students are falling farther and farther behind when compared to their international peers. And we live in a global economy, and those are the folks that they're going to have to compete with. If you look at where American students rank on proficiency tests, we rank in the mid-20s among the countries that we compete with. So obviously there's something going on with how we're teaching kids and what we're teaching kids that needs to be addressed.
Moving to the Common Core standards is a national movement. Historically, though, states have had the authority to decide for themselves what they want to teach. Are you at all worried that Ohio is giving up something that it should want to hang on to?
Well, I think, first place, it's very important to recognize this is not a top-down project, but rather this is a collaborative effort by the governors and the chief executives of the states, the superintendents of schools all across the country. They have come together and said, we need to work together to assure that we have sort of a uniform system. One of the problems that people have become acutely aware of is as we become a more and more mobile society and children move a lot, what they might learn in the fourth grade in one school and in one state is very different than what they might learn in the fourth grade in a different state. So that's one of the reasons why we feel like we need some sort of common standard. What sort of things do students need to know how to do in order to be successful?
The Ohio Department of Education says that in 2 years, when students start being tested on the Common Core, school districts could suddenly see their ratings drop. Are schools really as bad as the new grades might suggest?
Well, I think the reality to that question is yes. What we have done is we have lowered our cut scores to the point that they fall below the national cut scores. If you take a standardized test, let's just say it's in reading in third grade, the cut score is the level at which you are considered to be proficient, the number of questions you need to get right in order to be rated as proficient. On the Ohio standardized test, you need about 37% of the questions right to be rated as proficient. Now, on the NAEP, which is the national testing score that's sort of they take schools at random from across the country, proficiency is more at the 60% level. So that basically means a child who is proficient in reading in Ohio is not anywhere near at the same level that their national peers are. The international proficiency rate, or their cut score, is more like at 80.
Many teachers are excited about teaching to the higher standards, but some experts say they're not so sure that all teachers are prepared for the switch. This shift is happening at a time when school districts are laying off teachers, cutting back on the kinds of classes they offer, and are even increasing class sizes. Are lawmakers asking the impossible?
I think we're asking a lot. I think we should acknowledge that, and I think we need to be careful that we put enough time into allowing these changes to occur that is reasonable. I think we need to be aggressive about it, but at the same time, I think we need to be somewhat cautious that we're not asking too much.
I've been talking with State Senator Peggy Lehner. Thanks so much, Senator.
Thank you.
That's it for this week's edition of WISO Weekend. I'm Jerry Kenney. Thanks for joining us on member-supported 91.3 WYSO, Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield, and online at wyso.org, a broadcast service of Antioch University for the Miami Valley. Coming up next on WYSO, The Book Nook.